You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokawingawa. No mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Kaden, I'm your host for today, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Sanat. Efa Akene coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I asked about the Tāmaki Makaurau by-election, the latest updates on the Amazon data centre opening in Auckland, and a new exemption on the ban for foreign buyers. For International Desk, I spoke to Associate Professor in Disaster Resilience at the University of Newcastle, Iftikhar Ahmed, on the recent earthquakes in Afghanistan and the challenges of the disaster response. Sanat, what have you got for us today?
For city councilling this week, I spoke with Councillor Shane Henderson about the persistent rise in dog attacks across Auckland and public opposition to Auckland Council's proposed housing intensification changes. After that, I spoke to Vanessa Cole from the Public Housing Futures Campaign about New Zealand's state housing system and why the campaign is fighting for higher quality state housing. I also spoke to Tertiary Education Union spokesperson Sandra Gray about the government's response to the University Advisory Group's report.
Heaha or whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka awa e ware ware I ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō, he pakehele rokiroki mārunga I te pai, tukutuku o Erarangi Pōhō, mihaere ki 95BFM, erakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Advance voting is currently open for the Tāmaki Makaurau by-election, with the official election day on Saturday. The main contenders are Labour MP Penny Henare and Te Pāti Māori's Orine Kaipara. A newsroom investigation has questioned the accuracy of Amazon's claim that it will open several Amazon data centres in Auckland, boosting our economy. This follows an announcement from the Prime Minister that it will lead to 1,000 new jobs. Both Labour and National are clashing over who can claim credit for the announcement, as the Prime Minister's announcement from earlier this week is very similar to Labour's from 2021. Criticisms of the Amazon data centre also include environmental concerns and Amazon's failure to pay adequate tax on its New Zealand's revenue. And a new exemption has been announced to the 2018 ban on foreign buyers. The exemption will allow holders of a new visa to build or buy a home worth at least $5 million. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I asked Shannon Halbert about all of these topics. I started by asking how optimistic he was feeling about Labour's chances in the Tāmaki Makaurau by-election.
We've run a really positive campaign that has spoken directly to whānau and Tāmaki Makaurau and concentrated on real outcomes. Whether that be in the cost of living or more houses, more jobs, better access to healthcare. So I'm feeling positive, but the challenge in front of all of us over the next 48 hours will be turnout, and so we're doing everything that we can in door knocking and phone calling and talking to all of our whānau to make sure that they get out to vote.
What issues do you think the by-election has come down to?
Every whānau that we've spoken to on doorsteps has spoken about the challenges that this government has presented them with. The cost of living, people think that we're going backwards in that area, that things are getting more expensive, that access to good quality healthcare is more challenging, they can't get their kids to the doctor, there's less housing available for people when they need it. But most of all, they feel like this government has kicked them in the guts. And so their response to that is that they want to change the government.
Are you worried about the impact Hikoi Mō Te Tiriti could have in turning out support for Te Pāti Māori this election?
Well, I think it's challenging for both camps to get a good turnout. both parties are doing everything that they can to encourage their voters. We're focused more on a ground campaign, speaking directly to whānau and communities, and Te Pāti Māori have focused more online. So, you know, we'll see what the results are on Saturday, but at this stage only less than 500 people voted yesterday, and so we're both finding it a challenge.
Can you explain why Labor is concerned about the Prime Minister taking credit for the Amazon data centre announcement?
Well, it's pretty embarrassing for Christopher Luxon to claim that this investment is something that he's done when clearly that investment began under Labor.
But despite originally promising to build a data centre in 2021, there has been little progress. Are you still optimistic that Amazon building a data centre here will happen?
Well, always optimistic, but Christopher Luxon is the Prime Minister. He's responsible for those outcomes and that progress. And he spends so much time and energy claiming everything Labor did was wrong. And now, in this instance, he's claiming that Labor's achievement is his own.
In the context of things like the cost of power rising, are you still confident that an Amazon data centre here won't just be a drain on our resources?
That's been worked through, and we are confident from the information that we have, but I would expect that any good leader in Christopher Luxon would be having his finger on the pulse and ensuring that that work is done too.
A newsroom investigation has found that Amazon has been funneling New Zealand revenue overseas to avoid paying tax. Does that at all impact how supportive Labor is of the data centre opening?
Well, sure, we'll keep a close eye on that. But the Prime Minister is responsible for keeping an eye on that. If and when we're in government next year, we'll be making sure that we follow that through as well.
What is your response to the new exemption to the ban on foreign buyers?
Well, the government's decision to allow foreign buyers into the market will drive up prices and make life harder for Kiwis wanting to own their own home. I mean, everyone in my own community in the North Shore of Auckland tells me that they want to buy their first home, and that's why Labor did this in the first place. So it's a step backwards.
The government says this announcement strikes a good balance between investment and protecting New Zealand home buyers. What is your response to this?
Well, the announcement shows how out of touch Christopher Luxon really is struggling to buy a home, and he has just made it worse for them.
That was Labor's Shannon Halbert on the Tāmaki Makaurau by-election, the latest update on the Amazon data centre opening in Auckland, and a new exemption to the ban on foreign buyers.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
High numbers of roaming dogs in Auckland's communities have continued to be a persistent problem. New data revealed shows nearly 17,000 reports of unruly behaviour from dogs, with nearly 1,300 attacks on people and 1,200 attacks on other animals. Dog shelters are also increasingly under strain, with nearly 10,000 dogs being impounded in the last year. I talked to Councillor Shane Henderson today about what the drivers behind these increased incidents are and how Auckland Council is trying to respond. In other news, inner-city suburbs have been hosting public forums on Plan Change 78, a change to Auckland's zoning and intensification framework that would allow for development of high-density housing in the central isthmus. There's been vehement public opposition in inner-city suburbs, with residents shouting and heckling at MPs, councillors, and even members of the public that do support high-density housing. Councillor Christine Fletcher has also made claims that this housing intensification plan will cost Aucklanders nearly $20 billion in associated infrastructure costs. Mayor Wayne Brown has decried these claims, calling them, quote, complete rubbish. I wanted to talk to Councillor Henderson about why there is so much public opposition to the plan and whether housing intensification will change the city for the better or the worse.
Shane, there's been a record number of incidents of dog attacks and hostile dog behavior in our communities. Is there any primary drivers as to why there's so many attacks?
Yeah, it's a funny one. There seems to be an element of randomness to the sort of rise and fall of dog attacks in the community. But yeah, funnily enough, and I don't really know how to explain this, but where our sort of economic situation is going down, we sort of tend to see more dog attacks, and I have no idea why that is. But that seems to be a bit of a trend line. But, you know, look, it's a real concern for the community, and there are parts of the city where roaming dogs are a huge issue, and that's something that we've really got to get on top of and get a handle on. Luckily, we've got an animal control team in council that I think do a fantastic job. And honestly, they're some of the toughest people in Auckland as well. I just love their work, and you know, they're right on top of these things, yeah.
What do you reckon the path forward is? How can the community have some assurances that, you know, this is pretty much under control?
Yeah, part of it is resourcing at the council's end, and I understand that, we had a kind of a de-sexing drive that I think has been relatively successful, but it's also just getting that communication out there to people that we need to sort of, you know, have good ownership and good care of dogs when you do have them. Things like socialising them in dog parks, those things are super important, and it's kind of high time for us to sort of put more communication out around that so people understand a bit more about, you know, how to take care of dogs and make sure that they are not, to the best of your ability, kind of aggressive, right? I visited the Henderson Animal Shelter a couple of weeks ago, and yeah, it was definitely pretty packed out, but they do a fantastic job there as well. And yeah, this is the sort of stuff that we've got to keep resourcing.
Why do you think there's that sort of public opposition to more dense housing, potentially more affordable housing in the city?
Yeah, it's a hard one. You know, look, obviously, to start off, I respect people's democratic rights to make any argument they like around kind of how the planning of the city and the housing crisis that we have to be addressing in this city. People will have different ideas on that. So, you know, I do respect that, okay? But at the same time, as decision makers, we need to be looking holistically across the whole city and planning it properly. So where would you, if you were to start from scratch, right, where would you zone more housing? Well, obviously you would zone it in places where there are the best access to jobs, best access to study opportunities and the best public transport. And in a lot of cases, these are the central and the suburbs that have been historically, for the history of the city over decades, had the planning held down in terms of single house zones all across some of the best land of the city, and plenty of the suburbs within the central city have faced that, and now the proposal is that they take on a bit more housing and a bit more of their share around addressing the housing crisis and zoning for more housing in the right places. So honestly, I mean, as it's coming through, I support the changes. And some would say they might not even go far enough. But honestly, I think that it's something that we should be moving forward while at the same time respecting that people have different views.
One of your council colleagues, Christine Fletcher, came out with comments about how much this is going to cost, claiming that there'd be a requirement, especially in the Albert Eden Puketapa region, for 56 more primary schools, 23 more secondary schools, and land acquisition of 79 sites, totaling up to around $20 billion of cost in terms of infrastructure, like associated infrastructure for any housing developments. Is that true?
Well, from my perspective, I don't know why we would be so worried about the growth of the city into a world-class city that we can enjoy. And population brings vibrancy, it brings events, it brings economic opportunities to Auckland. And the flip side to that is, do we want to freeze our city in amber forever? Do we want to be a sleepy little village on the bottom of the South Pacific? Or do we actually want ambition? Do we actually want positive change? Do we want to give more opportunities for our young people and our young families? And if you do want that, then I don't know why we would be afraid of having more housing in an area, meaning that we need more schools or more hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. Those are good things. And that's an argument for more investment. It's not an argument for holding down housing supply. And just the other thing that I would add to that briefly is that, you know, the population is growing and housing has to go somewhere. And currently under the rules, before these changes sort of come into effect, we're building in West Auckland in huge amounts, where the infrastructure is less able to cope than some of the central areas that it's being proposed. We're also building over elite soils that is the economic lifeblood of our country for the future years. And, you know, those things are not acceptable and we need to be a lot smarter as a city. And I personally think this proposal actually is a lot smarter.
There's also been some comments, particularly from Labour MP Helen White, about how this is a particularly blunt instrument and Auckland Council is sort of unilaterally making decisions here, directed obviously by central government's new requirements around housing density. And she's asking for a more democratic and considered approach, like in Europe, where there's community buy-in on housing density and housing intensification. Is that something that Auckland Council is doing right now, or something that it needs to incorporate in its approach going forward?
Yeah, well, taking the community along with you is kind of an important thing to do and a necessary thing to do in terms of consultation and in terms of discussion. Frankly, with this kind of proposal, the discussion and the consultation has been ongoing for years. So there's been people saying that things are rushed, and I just do not accept that at all. People, you know, are having entire public meetings over this. They know what's going on, right? But the other discussion, the sort of problem that we have with some of that community consultation is future Aucklanders obviously don't, by definition, have a say. And that's something that, from my perspective, I really want to factor into that discussion, is that the people that want to live closer to the city but can't, well, they don't really get much of a say in these discussions. And when they do speak up, and there was someone in that meeting that sort of bravely put their hand up, they get overwhelmed and shouted down by the existing residents that have their own interests. So, you know, it's not a full picture when you're talking about consultation, and that's a real challenge. It's something that decision makers, I think, should have more in mind than they do at the moment.
A part of the changes proposed in this plan around 15-storey buildings. Now, I suppose a lot of the worry from the community is that suddenly there are going to be 15-storey buildings popping up everywhere across the central isthmus. Is this true, or can you paint me a picture of realistically what would happen under this plan?
Yeah, so that sort of level of intensity is designed to be going along the rapid transit corridors, particularly the rail stations in the city, because, you know, frankly, we're spending billions on a city rail link, and we need to get return on that investment in terms of the city shaping potential that it has, in terms of the economic opportunities that it can provide for us. And so to do that, I think it is really... it's a strong argument that we have to be intensifying along that rail corridor, otherwise what are we doing? Right, we're bringing the city closer to more Aucklanders than ever before through that investment, and yet there's arguments out there that we shouldn't be doing that. I don't really understand those arguments, to be honest. We should be intensifying along those rail corridors and providing vibrant communities and accessible communities for transport links. Yeah, so that's kind of my point of view on that, I suppose. Yeah.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson on rising dog attacks throughout the community and opposition to Plan Change 78, which promises to create high-density housing in the centre of the city.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. Text in your thoughts, 5395. This is The Field from Blood Orange.
I'm
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Get ready to make a mess and gear up to make some noise with Squish Bang Splat at MOTAT.
A day of hands-on fun with creative design challenges, art experiments, and percussion fun with drums. Plus, live science shows with the Little Scientist team, and so much more.
Squish, bang, splat at MOTAT, Saturday 6th and Sunday 7th of September.
Included in general admission. Find out more at motat.nz.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
What if you call it?
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Hello, my little sparrows. If you're listening right now, then this message was meant for you. Claim it if it resonates. I've got my tarot deck here. I'm going to pull a card to illuminate an intention for you. Just shuffling. Ooh, it's the B card. This card represents prosperity, greatness, clout. Oh, I love this for you. Expect an abundance of free things. Music, merch, coffee, ticket.
Get a B card today from 95BFM.com for just $4.20 a month and be in to win tickets, albums, and more.
West Coast. Chopping.
Regan. Regan, wake
East
up.
West Coast.
Honey.
On
shore. You're having those strange nightmares. Oh, no. No, it's not.
1 out of 10 on both coasts.
Oh, God. Father Damien, it's happening again.
Looking for tubular swells? It's the 95BFM Surf Report. Is the West Coast gnarly? Is the East Coast bogus? Do people even still use these words? Find out every morning on Breakfast and every afternoon on Drive. The Totally Radical Surf Report, proudly brought to you by the dudes and dudettes at ProGear.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International desk are go.
Over the weekend, a magnitude 6 earthquake struck eastern Afghanistan. The death toll has passed at least 1,400, with another 3,000 injured and 500,000 impacted. A strong aftershock, magnitude 5 earthquake, then struck the region on Tuesday. This comes as Afghanistan is struggling with a severe drought and a hunger crisis. I spoke to Associate Professor in Disaster Resilience at the University of Newcastle, Iftikhar Ahmed, about the earthquakes and the challenges with the disaster response. I started by asking if he could talk about the extent of the damage, including the death toll.
Well, the earthquake, the first earthquake, actually, there were two. There was one recently as well. The first one, which happened on Sunday, that devastated a large number of, you know, villages, close to the Pakistan border in northeastern Afghanistan and close to the city of Jalalabad. And already the count of deaths is over 1,400, and there are more people estimated to be trapped under rubble and not yet rescued. And so we'll still see the number rising, and more than 3,000 people injured. That's still rough figures. Now, in the meantime, there's been another earthquake just on Tuesday, and that was also, and they haven't managed to get any stats from that as such, because people were still working frantically to do the recovery work, the rescue and relief at this stage, really not recovery, rescue and relief stage at this work for the first earthquake. And this struck a slightly different area, the same region, but in a different area. So it's in these areas, as you may know, are very hard to reach. They're very remote, and many of the roads have been blocked by landslides caused by the earthquakes. So the second earthquake, we don't know. So we can imagine that at the end of the enumeration, if there's, you know, good estimate, it'd be close to 3,000 to 4,000 people dead, if not more. So it is actually a very large number of people lost. They haven't done any enumeration of the number of houses that's been damaged. And the main item that has been impacted is housing, really, and buildings, of course. But there in these remote areas, housing is the main form of building. They have some community buildings like schools and health clinics and stuff, but they're very scant.
So why is there such a high death toll and so many destroyed buildings?
Yes, that's actually a very central question. Most of the deaths happened because people got killed by collapsing buildings. And I again quote a widely quoted phrase, disasters or earthquakes don't kill people, buildings kill people. And that is what has happened in this case. Many of these buildings in that region, they are built with local materials like mud and stone. People don't have the access or affordability to build with manufactured modern building materials using professional standards and professional expertise. So there they go. And so these are built with the traditional knowledge and using local materials, and many of them are not built to the purpose. Now, if I may be get a bit technical, is that many of these buildings, or most of these buildings, are built in a what we call a monolithic form of construction. That is, without any reinforcement inside them, they are just like blocks of mud bricks or stones laid on top of each other with minimal mortar joints. So that is why they just collapse. And the roofing is normally made out of unprocessed, wrought lumber, as we call it, and that and covered with mud again, and mostly mud and stone. So that can easily collapse in shaking. So these buildings are not actually fit for earthquakes, and this is what has killed a large number of people. So again, the earthquake didn't kill people, the buildings did.
Afghanistan is in a very earthquake-prone region, but how does their disaster resilience compare to their neighbours?
Very poor, I would say that, simply because this earthquake is not an isolated event. There have been the whole region is seismically active. They have been having earthquakes. There was one in 2023, and there was one in 2022. Both had very large human death tolls and injuries and loss of homes and all that. So which what we are seeing playing out again over and over. And this has been going on for a long time. And every time there's an earthquake, people go back and build in the same way. And again, they suffer. And they may have also noticed that around them, these, even if they haven't been impacted by an earthquake, they know that in the surrounding villages, this is what happened, and that's because the building collapsed. But of course, they don't have the support, the institutional support to be able to build differently. If you look at countries in the region, say Pakistan, India, Nepal, some of these local countries which also have earthquakes from the same Hindu Kush and Himalaya belt, the two Eurasian and Asian plate tectonic plates colliding and causing these seismicity. So, but in these countries, you see that there are some guidelines, there's some effort to introduce earthquake-resistant construction, especially after disasters. In cities in India, like Ahmedabad, in Bhuj, for example, they have implemented that kind of construction. In Pakistan, after the 2005 earthquake, led by ERRA earthquake, Rehabilitation and Reconstruction Authority. In Nepal, after the 2015 earthquakes, the government took on board a very strong implementation of the building codes with some allowance for the rule of thumb, and so on. So you see, like, all kinds of things are happening in local, regional, in the region, in countries nearby with similar socioeconomic conditions. So it is not impossible for Afghanistan to follow these guidelines, but they have not been doing it. And I would blame this on the lack of leadership and lack of institutional support. Most of these initiatives that I mentioned need strong leadership support. They are community-based efforts. These are efforts that the community can understand and implement themselves, but they have to be driven by people who have the expertise and the knowledge to be able to support them to implement some of these ideas, which is somehow not happening in Afghanistan. And we can just hope that with this recovery process after this tragic earthquake, some of these lessons from other countries will be brought in and implemented.
Given the drop in aid to Afghanistan following the Taliban takeover a few years ago, will they have anywhere near the resources they need to rebuild?
Most likely not. The international funding, the donor funding supply has kind of dwindled, especially after the United States closed their funding agency, USAID, for example. And also other governments, they are strapped for resources because of many demands for international donor funding, for because of the wars in Israel and Gaza and in Ukraine. So a lot of the money is being spent on these conflicts in different parts of the world. And so for these kind of disasters, there's limited amount of money. And Afghanistan actually needs a lot of money. It's not just going and building homes. It's to get that right infrastructure in place, get the community infrastructure in place, building up safe refuges so that if there's another earthquake, people can get protection. So there's a whole gamut of things that need to be done, but they certainly won't have a fraction of that amount of money required to be able to do that kind of recovery.
Are there calls for other countries to send more aid and support for earthquake relief?
Yes, there are. But if you are following the news, you see that certain countries want to target the money. Certain countries, like the UK, for example, want to target the money so where it's needed, not giving it to the Taliban and then spend it on something else. And what is needed out there is also the people who are the most vulnerable, particularly the women and the children. The large number of deaths in Afghanistan after these two earthquakes have been women and kids. So that is where the money needs to go to give them that kind of support. But whether the Taliban would do that, that's questionable. So many of these governments, they want to target that aid and see that it reaches the right people. And that might create some kind of dilemmas and conflicts. So we don't know yet how that'll play out.
How concerned are you about Afghanistan's disaster resilience moving forward?
I think, as I mentioned earlier, it needs good leadership, good governance. The knowledge and the technology and the technical expertise, that is all known already. They have been tried and tested in other countries in the region. And what I was saying about many of these countries adopting, it's not like, you know, you're going to get a 100% earthquake-proof nation. But what you will be able to do is to reduce the kind of fatality numbers that we are seeing, the huge numbers of people who are dying, and implement a certain level of safety. But that is what is desirable. But even to do that, it would need that kind of institutional and governance support, which is at the moment lacking in Afghanistan.
That was Associate Professor in Disaster Resilience at the University of Newcastle, Iftikhar Ahmed, on the recent earthquakes in Afghanistan and the challenges of the disaster response.
International Desk on 95 BFM.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
Kāinga Ora, New Zealand's state housing provider, has been subject to deep cuts under the current coalition government. Current housing demand demonstrates that nationally nearly 30,000 houses are required. However, most developments that were in Kāinga Ora's pipeline have since been cancelled, with the most recent cut coming in Whanganui, where 138 planned houses have now been cut down to 7. This comes at the same time as the government is trying to stimulate a sluggish housing market by offering tax incentives to property owners, lowering interest rates, and opening up New Zealand's housing market to overseas investors. This is in the hopes that private developers in the market can cater to the overrun demand that also exists. I talked to Vanessa Cole from the Public Housing Futures Campaign, a group that is trying to halt the deep cuts that are currently being experienced by Kāinga Ora.
I was just wondering if you could give me a little bit of insight into the Public Housing Futures Campaign.
Of course. So we are fighting for a housing system where everyone has decent, stable and suitable housing, and see state housing as a key pathway towards this. It ensures that people can stay in their communities, close to their schools, hospitals, sports clubs. When we get rid of state housing, it impacts on our whole communities, and it makes all of our housing more unaffordable. So the support state housing campaign we're running at the moment is about supporting local communities to run local campaigns for state housing to try to stop the sell-off that's happening right now, but also to build public support for state housing. We know that leading up to the last election, we saw a small but very loud groups of people around the country that were protesting against kāinga ora being built in their communities. But we know that there are more people around the country that want to see their neighbours in decent housing. We currently have 13 groups who are starting to build campaigns locally, and we're encouraging people to join them and to start their own local campaigns to defend and extend state housing.
Can you maybe give me some more insight into what the current government is doing in regards to state housing, what the sell-off actually looks like?
Yeah, of course. So when the government came into power, they got this review into, this independent review into kāinga ora that was being led by Bill English, who, when he was in the previous national government, was a key driver of the social housing reform program, which was also trying to dismantle state housing. And that report came back and said a claim that kāinga ora was not financially viable, and really pushing this debt narrative, which we know is not really legitimate, because we can actually borrow to build the houses that we need, and the debt that kāinga ora has is nothing really to worry about when you look at the amount of houses that it owns. And so they went ahead and started dismantling kāinga ora from the inside out, gutting it. They put pause on the construction of state housing across the country, and recently have now cancelled nearly 3,500 homes, 213 developments across the country, which would have provided decent and stable homes to people. Many of these developments were on land which used to have state housing on it, where families living in it that were forced out on this promise that we would get more state houses built. They are also selling around 900 state houses a year, which they say they're selling off in wealthy areas, but in every single one of these communities where they're selling off state housing, there's wait lists of people who are waiting to get into state housing. All of these communities need state housing, and so this sell-off is happening at quite a rapid pace at the moment. It's hard to even keep an eye on the amount of houses that are being sold off. And so they're dismantling kāinga ora and dismantling the state housing program. And at the same time, they're really propping up the private housing market and the private housing system. I think something that's kind of been less advertised is that in the absence of state housing, the government's really pushing this idea of affordable rentals. They amended the Overseas Investment Act, which allows international investors to essentially invest and build to rent. And real estate is finding these new ways to profit from the fact that we have more and more people renting. And so the government's brought back no-cause evictions. They're dismantling state housing. They transferred $2.9 billion to landlords. It's very clear that they are supporting and the profits of investors over everybody having a home.
Now, the argument the government might make here is that supporting the market and in some instances, or in a lot of instances, supporting landlords with tax incentives and tax breaks and bringing in overseas investment means that they're setting up the private market to be able to deliver the housing needs of the community and the demand that exists. Do you think that's true?
I think that it's pretty clear from our history that the private market has failed to adequately house people. I think when we get rid of state housing, which is one of the only like permanently affordable forms of housing, what we do is we leave space open for people being forced into the private rental market, which means that there's more profits for investors. We've got Chris Bishop kind of really pushing this idea that if we just build more houses, we're going to solve the housing crisis. But if all those houses are luxury apartments for those who can afford it, everyday people in our communities are going to be priced out of their neighbourhoods. This is why state housing is so essential. So if we build more state housing in our communities, it means that more people can have access to actually affordable housing, and it makes all of our housing more affordable when private landlords are forced to compete with somebody who does not make profit. So I think that we've got to be wary of the idea that the private market will solve the housing crisis when we have never seen that happen throughout history.
One of the things that I'm interested in understanding is, you know, if there's a well-resourced state housing provider that can, that has the mandate to build these houses, there still needs to be, you know, a procurement and construction process to build these houses at a high quality and at the scale that's needed. But New Zealand struggles with that a lot of the time. It struggles to build on scale and for the needs of the many. We saw, you know, what was a pretty clear failure of the Kiwi Build program back in the first, the 2017 Labour government as well. How do you think your campaign is advocating for a better state housing system than the one we've had in the past?
Yeah, so one thing on that is that we have built state housing at scale before. The first Labour government built a lot of houses during the 1930s and 40s. And so it's not that it's impossible. I think it is very possible that we can build at scale. But what we want to do is to imagine a state housing system that's better than what we've had in the past. We want to have really high quality, sustainable, culturally adequate housing that really meets the needs of our communities, that is accessible for our disabled whānau and for our ageing population, that's future-proof, that is climate resilient. And so I think that Kāinga Ora was getting to a stage where they were figuring out the systems that work to build housing at scale and with good quality, because when you remove the profit motive from housing, we're actually building housing that is for us and is for the future, and is, we are not just building for quick profits to be made, but actually building housing that's going to last and is going to be really good quality for people in our community. So we're imagining a different state housing system that not only houses many people. So right now, state housing is only really available to those who are the most at risk of homelessness. But if we build at scale and we build good quality housing at scale and we make it more available to more people in our communities, that means that people from different income levels will have access to it. It means that we have planned control over the way in which housing is built, and it's not built just to make a quick buck. And so I think Kāinga Ora was getting there, but the gutting of Kāinga Ora and the dismantling of it means that we are going to see houses built, but maybe not to the quality and the standard that we deserve. Over the years, state housing has been kind of sidelined as a solution to our housing crisis, and this happened kind of really intentionally. So in the 90s, we saw the introduction of the accommodation supplement, which is essentially a subsidy for landlords, take over what was a state housing system. And so we need to be supporting the idea that state housing could become a bigger part of our housing system again. And that needs to happen alongside support for hapū and iwi to be able to have their own housing aspirations and to have land returned, and for you know, a housing system that is built not for profit but for everybody having a space to live.
How can people get involved in the campaign if they're interested in the work that you're doing?
You can email us at publichousingfutures@gmail.com, or you can come onto our website, which is publichousingfutures.com, and sign up to a local campaign, and we'll get in touch about ways that you can get involved to organise locally to stop the sell-off, but also to reimagine what housing might look like for your community.
That was Vanessa Cole from the Public Housing Futures Campaign on the importance of a well-resourced state housing program.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts 5395 on any of our pieces. This is Urban Planning from Geneva AM.
95 BFM presents The Others Way, Saturday, November 29, where you can see Geneva AM live.
Ko whakapuna ki te maunga, ko wai kare moana te roto, ko wai paua te marae. Ko horuta te waka, ko ngāti hinga hinga te hapu, ko ngāti rua pane te iwi, tēnā koe.
I wanna believe I'm never alone. How does it feel when you're finally home? I wanna believe I'm never alone. How does it feel when you're finally home?
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
The University Advisory Group, headed up by Sir Peter Gluckman, made more than 60 recommendations to improve the fragmentation, poor governance, and funding woes of the university sector. Sitting above them all was the highest priority call to set up a standalone government agency to administer separate strategy and funding for universities. The government has said no. Tertiary Education Minister Shane Reddy's priorities include the following areas: lifting student achievement, maximizing impact and innovation, or the ability to commercialize research, increasing access and participation for students from all backgrounds and regions, and boosting the international education sector to help improve economic growth and the country's university rankings. I spoke to the Tertiary Education Union spokesperson, Sandra Gray, about the government's response to this report and whether it will change the tertiary education sector fundamentally to respond to the persistent challenges that have affected New Zealand's universities.
The University Advisory Group, headed up by Sir Peter Gluckman, recently released a report, and the government has just put out a response to that report saying exactly what they're going to be prioritizing. What I wanted to understand is the Tertiary Education Union's perspective on both the UAG report and what the Minister Shane Retty has put out as the government's response. Could you give me some insight?
Absolutely. Look, I'm going to go straight to Shane Retty's response because, of course, it's the government's response to the report that really matters to staff and to students. And I'm going to say it's a real mixed bag. First of all, no one is going to argue with Shane Retty about ensuring more students study, more students complete their courses. It's how you get that happening that we might differ on. And I would say one of the things that's needed right now is more support to students so they are not struggling to pay the bills, not having to work 30 hours a week just to make ends meet so they can prioritise their studies. So if you want more people studying and you want more people completing, you give them decent support as students. So we're going to agree with that. We want more people getting access to transformative education opportunities and we want them well supported. We don't agree with the minister a decision to basically set up an advisory group which he will control, which will determine what happens to the universities and that the vice chancellors will sit on. The UAG report said something quite different. It said have some academics and some lay people putting together a strategy and being the strategic head of the university sector. What the minister's done is given himself more control over the sector, and that's not good for the country. We want our universities to be independent and step away from the state so that if we have to critique the state and say the government's not doing a good job, we can. But if he's controlling everything as a minister or the next minister controls everything, how can we claim that we've got institutional autonomy? And I say that's not good for anyone. In terms of commercialisation, of course we want universities involved in research, which helps us as a country and increases our innovation. But it's very narrow on what the minister's looking at, as opposed to what the UAG said, which is we need research of all types in New Zealand. We need good social science and humanities research. We need good scientific research. And not all of that is commercialisable. I mean, some of that research will never earn a dollar, but it will help make better lives in Aotearoa. It will help people live better lives. So we need that research as well. So there is a bit of a mixed bag in there, but I think the big missing piece is, where is the money, Minister, for good quality teaching and research to ensure staff aren't overworked and to ensure that students can focus on their studies? That's the question that is still missing from this whole piece.
Now, notably, part of this report proposes a slightly different governance structure to how universities are operated, and you've outlined that the minister has rejected those proposals and has instead consolidated more authority within the state to regulate how universities are governed. Notably, though, in either of those conversations, the Tertiary Education Union and staffing and teaching staff, research staff, have not been identified as key stakeholders for either governance proposal. What do you have to say to that?
Well, it's always been the case that occasionally governments remember that students are important voices in this, but they don't see the staff as an important voice, and it is to their detriment. The staff of the universities, whether they're librarians or professors, whether they're technicians or, you know, they work in administration, know what's needed to support students. They know what's needed academically. Politicians just don't know that stuff. So we need to make sure that the governance includes staff and student voice and includes it genuinely, not just as a kind of a last thought. We want our academic communities and staff and students to have academic freedom. We want them to be able to speak out. We want them to be able to study all sorts of things that they are driven to study and to research. And that won't happen if you don't let them have control of the institutions.
One of the biggest challenges to the tertiary sector has notably been that universities have to meet certain performance criteria financially, right? They have to, display budget surpluses, and that has often in some ways halted necessary investment from universities as well. What do you have to say about the financial structure of the tertiary sector? Is that fit for purpose, or is it an outdated model that needs changing?
Well, the UAG report itself says we need to move away from the kind of bums on seats. More students means more money approach to funding. We need to think more strategically and more collaboratively as a sector. We'd agree on that. You know, we're a small country, 8 universities. Let's all work together to deliver what's best for Aotearoa. But to decide that, as I say, that would have to come to staff and students being fully involved and the community and iwi hapu. This is not something that a government alone can do. Overall, New Zealand invests less than most developed nations in its tertiary sector, and it is showing. And the report said that. The UAG report said staff are overworked, you know, that students are struggling to survive financially. So one of the things New Zealand needs to decide is, do we want a world-class university system? We currently have one, but it is now so stretched, we're seeing a slide in international rankings. We need to decide whether New Zealanders deserve quality tertiary education, and then we need to tell the government to put the money in.
That was Sandra Gray from the Tertiary Education Union on the University Advisory Group's report and wider challenges facing the tertiary education sector.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nē te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rā Pārē Thursday. Nē rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, Labour's Shannon Halbert, the University of Newcastle's Dr. Iftikhar Ahmed, Auckland Council's Shane Henderson, Public Housing Futures' Vanessa Cole, and the Tertiary Education Union's Sandra Gray. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.